We are going to start this morning by taking a look at land prices, how they might be shaping the look and the feel and the function of the country. We're going to hear from a number of different voices, some saying that land prices are so high that they're pushing farmers off the land. Others, this is nothing new, that farmers have been buying land that they can't afford for as long as there has been land. I want to start with a visit to a farm that may, before too long, not be a dairy farm anymore. Donal Sheehan is a voice that will be known to many Countrywide listeners from the Bride Project in North Cork. Donal rents half of his farm, and when that half was put on the market recently, he was unable to afford to buy it. We have a nice mix of grasses going on here, and only a few docks for somebody who's gone organic.
That'll improve. Would you believe it? Now, this was a multi-species sward when we planted it back in 2016.
Uh-huh.
It was one of the first, I'd say, because it was John Finn. I knew John Finn.
Down the years, Donal has worked very hard to transform his dairy farm to a little pocket of biodiverse richness. The final step was going organic. And by last year, he'd have been forgiven for thinking that he had got it all figured out.
It was a very easy way of farming in that... The cow numbers matched what I was trying to achieve, even from an environmental point of view. Like in 2017, our nitrogen usage was 37 ton. We brought that down then to 20 ton in 2020. Last year we used a half a ton, and this year then I converted to transitioned over to organic because I was nearly there anyway. Like the nitrogen and the pesticides was never a problem because we don't use them anyway. I dropped cow numbers from 75 to 65. To make sure I wasn't going to run out of grass.
So by 2023, you must have felt like you were sitting pretty. The right number of cows, yeah. Virtually nil fertiliser yeah. usage.
Yeah, so we were ticking all the right environmental boxes, as it were. We were after reducing our carbon footprint because we had reduced cow numbers. Our methane emissions were down because we had gone from 75 cows down to 65. Our nitrous oxide emissions were completely gone because we had no more chemical nitrogen. Okay. And we were regeneratively farming because all our slurry now was replacing the chemical nitrogen. So
tick, 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 tick all the way down the list. But then, as they say, when men make plans, the gods smile.
It was always very precarious because when you rent ground, you don't own it. The land came up for sale, and we were able to put in a bid of 18,000 an acre. That's
18,000.
Yeah,
and you 18,000.
Yeah, and you have to remember, Philip, that there's no return of investment on 18,000 an acre. This is what you do. I mean, myself and my wife, you know, we cobbled together what we could. We went to the bank, and that's what we came up with, 18,000 an acre.
But there was somebody with deeper pockets.
Yeah, and this is the law of the jungle. Even at 18,000 an acre, I would have been 75 years by the time I'd have it paid off. So it would be landed with whoever's taken over the farm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was going to the bank, pleading your case, saying, trying to give a sustainable story because that's what we're all supposed to do. And that's what they came up with. But, you know, I had gone organic. So I was after dropping my cow numbers from 75 down to 65.
And did the bank advise you to go intensive and ditch this organic
nonsense? That was because the repayment capacity is based on the number of cows you have. It's not based on your sustainability criteria going forward. And I was told that I should consider going back up to 75 cows and not going organic because ultimately your repayment capacity depends on the number of cows you have.
What happens now then? How much of your farm do you lose when you have to vacate these fields?
I'd be down to under 50 cows, you know, especially with organic. And the viability of that going forward in, yeah, you just, you know.
Tell me.
Well, you know, it would be just tough to, you know, to make a living. There's farmers doing it. In what I was trying to do here, it would just be difficult.
So, how was calving?
it was straightforward enough. So these are the last few Anguses and Herefords, and they'll go to a local beef farmer down in Lismore.
So what are your choices then? Or is there really only one? Stop farming.
That will probably won't happen, Philip, because I'm just moulded now at this stage, you know. My fulfilment is farming and dealing with animals and being out with nature, and that's what drives me. And so, you know, putting me in an office or anywhere else, it just wouldn't float my boat, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, people have pivoted before, and I'll have to make the changes. These are the changes that are happening. You know, I'll have to make changes so that I can survive. I've a family, and you know, that has to come into play as well. You have to ensure that there's some income coming in, you know.
Do you have a sense of yours being yet another family that's not going to still be on the land come the next generation?
This farm it's going back to 1840 with the same family, and you know, that comes into play. You don't want to be the generation that didn't continue it on. But we are in really challenging times, and everything. What floored me is how quickly this changed. You know, I would have seen myself as being somewhat viable, although precarious, because the land was rented. But, you know, in the space of a month, I was looking at my own viability as a dairy farmer. It was frightening, you know. You just don't expect it to happen. But it did happen, and I'll have to face it. And, you know, there's other people have loads of difficulties out there, and I'm sure, you know, I'll survive. But
Your health, you have assets to sell, absolutely. I mean, you're not on the side of the road. But at the same time, what does it do to you to be the person who broke that 180 years of tradition?
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult because it's my bread and butter, and it's my life. It's my family's life. It was what we were born, bred, and reared to do. It's what my father before me did, and that's not to say, you know, that I can't change. Of course, I can change, and you know, you do what you have to do to make a living, but. It's the kind of love of my life, you know, and it's just, I suppose, it's just hard to swallow, that's all.
As we walked back through the fields that have been sold and will presumably now be put to a different purpose, Donal points out a stone chat sitting in a corner allowed to go to scrub.
Shorter, where is he?
Him up in the wire.
I can't see his markings from here.
Yeah, he's a black head, and then he's a white kind of a collar, and he's a red breast then, really, and his mate is always with him. The two of them are always together.
Stone chats feed on insects, and this pair presumably returned because Donald stopped using insecticides.
And they were never here before?
No.
That's a sense of achievement now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And even that pond, you see the water hens further down and the chicks.
Oh, yeah.
They were never there before until we allowed that pond to remain.
You must feel proud of that.
Yeah, it's small little things like that that float my boat. I don't, you know, but maybe I should change. Maybe I should be looking at the milk dockets and more important things.
Do you really feel that?
This is, you know, it's maybe a fault of mine, like, you know, that I put such value on
nature over business.
Yeah, weakness in the system.
So then, is Donal Sheehan the next in a long line who will be pushed off the land by unchecked market forces, or is it wrong to draw general and drastic conclusions from one admittedly upsetting story? Brian Leonard is from Sligo Farming Stock, but makes a living in UCD Agriculture Department, where, among other things, he examines the economic role of the farm in rural Ireland. Daniel Long is a Tipperary farmer campaigning for state intervention in the market, as happens in some other European countries. And in the absence of a register telling us who bought what, for how much and for what purpose, land agent Michael Brady can tell us what he has seen going on in his area of operations in Munster. Good morning to all three of you gentlemen. Michael, can I start with you first, please? When farmland comes on the market now, who tends to be at the top of the queue? Is it investors or is it other farmers?
Good morning, Philip. Thank you for having me on. I suppose the first thing I would point out, Philip, is that we've 140,000 farmers in the year. There are about somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 land transactions every year. So it's a very small percentage of landowners or farmers who actually buy land. So to answer your question, who actually are those 2,000 to 3,000 transactions every year? Full-time commercial farmers are top of the tree. Dairy farmers are very often touted as the ones that are buying up all the land. That's not necessarily true in all areas. Yes, dairy farming is probably more profitable than most of the other traditional enterprises. So full-time commercial dairy farmers are certainly part of that equation. Next in line would be part-time farmers with off-farm income. Okay, like we heard a good story there from Donald Sheehan. Like he mentioned, he went to the bank and he himself and his spouse went to the bank. So I'd assume there was an off-farm income as well. So you need both to try and go buy land. Then you've cash-rich tax investors that are buying. Tax is a big driver of land for large plots of land in general. Sometimes it's maybe dying down a bit again. Over the last couple of years when interest rates were low, some business people invested in land. Then you have forestry, your forestry companies. You have developers and compulsory purchase, developers for housing. You have compulsory purchase for roads. And I suppose the last one, which is new, we have, which should be in your own scene, and we probably have an emergence of an environmental investor. The state are buying land. You know, they bought, is it Miles Gap below in Kerry recently? So that's a new angle to the moment.
Remind us, will you please, of the tax loophole that the wealthy are using land purchases to avail of, and tell me how big a part of the picture that is.
Well, there's land and businesses are an efficient way to transfer wealth, we'll say cash, from one generation to the next. If you take somebody living in three-bedroom Simi D in Dublin or Cork or Limerick and you want to give some cash to your children, the limit is, I think, 335,000 for capital acquisitions tax, CAT. There's a special relief called agricultural relief for farmland and for farms, and there's a relief called business relief for businesses, whereby an asset is reduced to 10% of its value for tax purposes. So a simple calculation, you can get 3.3 million worth of land and pay no capital acquisitions tax. Okay.
And how big a part of the picture is that?
I believe, certainly for trophy properties, very large properties. You know, like in Ireland last year, I think we had 4 or 5 10 million plus properties in the country for sale. In my career, and I'm over 30 years in the business, that's the first time I've ever seen that in this country, where, you know, there were farms or land or estates and over 10 million euros. To me, tax is the driver of all those investments.
Okay. But important piece of context here is that still top of the list in any land transfer is farmers and dairy farmers at the top of that list. Let me go to Brian Leonard. UCT. Brian, in the last 40 years, we've seen 100,000 farms being amalgamated or gobbled up by other farms, basically. That's 100,000 families, maybe times 4 people in each family that have left the land. Do you think now that that is a process that is going to accelerate or continue at the same pace with these land prices?
Good morning, Philip. I really think the trends are showing that it, the acceleration that you mentioned maybe isn't going to take off. It's going to be more of the same. And as Michael mentioned there, land mobility is quite low in Ireland. Less than 1% of agricultural land at a national level actually goes on sale in the open market every year. So I don't think there's going to be acceleration. The family farm model has been dominant in Ireland and across Europe so far. Familial inheritance is the dominant way in which to get into farming. So I don't believe there's going to be a large boost in sales.
Okay, notwithstanding that though, if it is somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of land that changes hands every year, that means that by 2050, somewhere between 12.5% and 0.25% of the country could change hands and maybe change purpose.
Possibly. I don't want to enter too much speculation, I suppose, Philip. But as Michael mentioned as well, the vast majority of these buyers are farmers. And the other thing is you have to look at maybe the different parts of the country and the levels of income associated with farm systems that are dominant there. So in the south and southeast, of course, dairy and tillage are dominant. They traditionally have had higher incomes, whereas in the west where I'm sitting at the moment, you have suckler and sheep farmers where incomes are lower. So I don't necessarily see this, even if we got to our, as you mentioned, the 12% level of land mobility across so many years, the buyers are still farmers, and we have historically been buying land for more than what it is worth in terms of economic return.
Daniel, you're no stranger to pressure on land in your part of the country in Tipperary, but since starting the campaign that you've embarked on this issue, you've had farmers from all over the country say to you that they're at the sharp end of the same problem. Tell me what you've been hearing.
Well, I suppose our campaign would have started probably, I suppose, maybe over 2 months ago. And it was born out of, I suppose Tipperary, where I'm from, is kind of an epicentre where you see an awful lot of consolidation and very high value for land. But I think we need to remember that, like, when we mention a family farm, like that's currently without a definition, and we don't really have a size or a model that fits all of what we work off of. But the petition essentially was started by farmers and people from the environmental community and people from the scientific and academic community. And the idea behind it was that we would try and get as many signatures as possible from those, with the idea of mandating us to hold a meeting around the idea of setting up a land observatory, which is currently in our land use policy.
What is a land observatory and how would it work, Daniel?
So a land observatory essentially would have... oversight initial stages it would act as a watchdog, but would have oversight over land use and preserve landscape and the viability of rural communities and provide access to farmers access to land for young farmers and generational renewal. Because we need to remember, we have a very high average age of farmers in this country, and we have a very small percentage of young farmers taking on land. And while we're saying that the farms are transferring onto other farms, like, what we don't want is a situation where an awful lot of the land is concentrated in very few of the farmers of Ireland, like, which is no good for Ireland. Like, we have a family farm model, and that's what we base our exports on.
Daniel, I can see why young farmers might be interested in something like that. I would imagine that older farmers would be very resistant to anybody sticking their nose into their ability to sell their land to whomever they want for the highest value that they can get.
Well, as it would, like, first and foremost, like, what we want is, like, we have an open market, and people should be able to attain the maximum value for their property as possible. But we also need to remember that we have a community responsibility as well. Like, and a lot of these land, when you do consolidate farms, there is a biodiversity issue, because, like, farms that need to increase in scale may have small paddocks and hedgerows, and you see a lot of hedgerows removal, which is a feature that happens in Tipperary when you see consolidation of land. And, like, it's multifaceted as well. And, like, an observatory, like, as I said, this isn't new. Like, France have had it since the 1960s. Scotland are currently looking at it. It could actually be a vehicle for collaboration among science, environmental groups and agriculture, rather than division, which you see an awful lot in farming at the moment.
Brian, one of the interesting things that's quite often overlooked in this conversation is that the Constitution gives expression, or says, that the Oireachtas should do whatever it can to support the family farm in the circumstances and the best circumstances that shall be practicable, I think it says. Is what Daniel is proposing here a practical way of giving expression to that?
Yeah, I suppose, look, there are things in place at the moment as well to protect that family farm model in terms of taxation and favourable taxation to transfer within families. But what Daniel mentioned there, of course, it's definitely something that's worth monitoring. I think at the moment, based on the, as I mentioned, the low land mobility figures, maybe moving to any level of legislative or a regulation might be too early. But I would 100% agree with Daniel in terms of if we were to collect data on that and ensure that it's something that's monitored so we do avoid, you know, large-scale land consolidation. And also, I just want to maybe mention as well, Daniel, mentioned kind of a lack of definition for a family farm. At a European level, a family farm is generally defined as one that's managed and operated by a household where the labour is generally supplied from within that family household. So it's a broad enough definition, but there is a general definition there.
Michael, I wonder, does viability matter to most of the people that you see in these queues to buy land when it comes on the market? Or are they thinking more in terms of legacy and standing in the community and something to pass on to the next generation?
Philip, I think like the conversation we've been having there for the past 5 minutes is very local. It's an Irish, like we're even going down to county level, okay? If we jump up a bit higher and look at this more on a global scale, okay, the land market in Ireland is absolutely unique. To answer your question, viability is irrelevant. It's whether you can afford it or not is the question. And like the question I will get asked wearing my consultants hat, if a farmer wants to buy land, how can I buy it? He's not asking me the return on investment. He's not asking me whether it's a good investment or a bad investment. It's like the Donal Sheehan example. Donal Sheehan could arrive into my office and say, I want to buy this land, how do I get it?
Right. Okay. And do you ever advise any of these people and say, no, that is a bad return on your investment. Go spend your money somewhere else.
My job is to put the options on the table to the client. Okay. But like, we've got a history with land in this country, and like the reason you have to ask, you have to look at yourself and ask the question, why is return on investment not on the table here? It's number one, because of so little land comes for sale. Sometimes you have people saving up for generations to be able to buy the bachelor farmer next door that they're waiting to pass on. So that's not, that could be in Parish A, but in Parish B, there might be three places of pieces of land come up for sale at the same time, which would bring down the value. So it's just not real. Like if I was in Australia recently, and if you go to Tasmania, country about the same, or an island about the same size as Ireland. Now, half it is forestry, but over 50% of the land in that country is owned by corporates. And it was interesting, I chatted to some dairy farmers there, and they were actually in favour of the corporates buying because they said that the farmers themselves would not have the capital to develop the farms. Like you'd an excellent conversation with Donald Sheehan there, and Donald was doing his figures, adding up every last penny. He said he could go 17,000 or 18,000 an acre on the land, and I think it made 26 or 7,000 an acre, right? But if he did buy that, he would have had no money to invest in that land over the next 10 or 15 years. Whereas the argument that was made to me for Tasmania was a corporate pension fund, whatever, come in, they buy 1,000 hectares, they develop the farm. But the thing that people don't realise, they create a lot of jobs as well, okay? So the Donald Sheehan could go in and run the dairy farm on that and maybe make even more money and still have his own farm.
But it is still about attachment and legacy and all of
those
things.
In this country it is. Yeah. In this country it is. So it's not about return investment. It's about a row of 40 medals on the chest.
Where Bull McCabe killed the American, his modern day equivalent goes and takes out a multi-generational mortgage. Michael Brady, thank you very much. And Daniel Long and Brian Leonard too. Let's take a break.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Let me clarify that although land is going for 26, 27 grand an acre in some cases, that was not actually what the sale price on that land in Cork actually went for at the end of the day.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.